So, if it's Sunday, it's the Q Report. I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Gabe Rosner.
Hey, Gabe, what's going on?
You know, Sunday, enjoying my sunny Sunday.
You look like you're enjoying it. It's been a pretty amazing week. We have a lot to talk about. I should cover some business. We are brought to you by Picnic. Will Goldfarb's unbelievable stands down by the water in Manhattan. He uses All Heritage Foods. Pretty cool place. That's PICKNIK. Well, yeah, this has been a very, very busy week. What's any highlights for you, Gabe?
Not that I can go into incredible detail on.
Because you work on a high secret mission. I mean,
totally.
You actually are the right-hand person and driver of a prominent political figure.
I would say the driver. I would definitely not say right-hand person, but I'm definitely the driver of a elected.
I can imagine how important that relationship is, just also for... Does she bounce ideas off you? I mean, I would imagine...
She doesn't bounce much off me, but she also doesn't, you know, watch what she says around me. So I get to...
She trusts you.
Yeah.
Well, I'm talking about political figures. We had a passing of a great senator.
Yeah, major passing.
First time in 62 years that a Kennedy has not held a high office. That's quite a long dynasty. And, you know, it was just very interesting. I mean, I had a few points. I mean, he worked for 46 years in the Senate. And he was once told this bit of advice by Richard Russell, a senator of Georgia: you go further if you go slow. And sure enough, day in and day out, decade after decade, this guy was responsible for the passing of, I don't know, 400 or 500 laws or something.
It's unbelievable.
Like that. And just the you know, Congress, I mean, the Senate in particular, is almost rigged and created to be slow. So, you know, it doesn't reward rash decisions. I mean, this is the U.S. And so in order to have success in it...
It needs patience.
Yeah, patience. You know, something his brothers didn't have as much. You know, he was like the perfect Senate material. He's actually been compared to one of the... I've heard that the four greatest senators of all time... were him, Daniel Webster, John Caldwell Calhoun, and Clay.
What is the determination on what designates best senator ever?
Well, I know that Webster, Calhoun, and Clay were considered part of the Great Triumvirate, or the Immortal Trio. And it was Henry Clay with Daniel Webster and Calhoun. I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably just the ability to get deals made, reach across the aisle, calming. You know, one of those guys was called the Great Pacifier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically get a bunch of wealthy, successful guys to actually do something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Alone in D.C., away from their family and social network. Like, anyway, very interesting stuff. Well, we have two amazing guests. Two are going to be calling in later, but it's a real honor to have Mike Edison in house. You know Mike for
a
while.
I do know Mike. Mike and I are old friends.
How's it going, Mike?
It's going very well this morning. Thank you. Glad to be here. Glad to be here with you, Gabe, especially.
Thank you, Mike.
Your face tells 1,000 stories.
Oh, there's 1,000 more that you can't even see.
Oh my God.
I'm intrigued by you driving a high-ranking city official around.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder if the whole world's gone topsy-turvy or not.
You know,
the idea that you may somehow be affecting policy.
You know? I used to write policy for it, too.
Oh, man. Some crazy world we live in, huh?
One day Gabe will be mayor and, you know, it'll all
make sense.
All be subject to his policies.
You know, we're talking about Ted Kennedy, and it just begs the question of what liberalism actually means. And I posit that the current definition may be Gabe driving around New York City listening to a city official. And
while collecting unemployment.
Driving a police car around New York City.
Incredible.
It's fantastic.
Are you packing heat right now?
I mean... In what sense?
Oh my God! Well, Mike, we could talk about a million things. I mean, just for our listeners who don't know who Mike is, I mean, he is, you know, a writer and a musician. It seems foremost, but really a cultural mover and shaker. And you were the publisher of High Times, You were a hustler and penthouse scribe. You were the editor-in-chief of Screw Magazine, which has gone out of business since your departure.
All true, all true.
And I want to kind of start off with, I have other questions, great Led Zeppelin wine pairing and this and that, but I'd love to talk about, before we get to your book, wrestling, your connection to wrestling. I find that a real interesting subculture, and I was a huge Andy Kaufman fan, who I know is a big wrestler.
Well, the great thing about Andy Kaufman is he understood professional wrestling in a way that was very fundamental, and I don't think even his fans did. He understood it as performance art. He understood it as this great theater of the absurd. And, you know, think about, you know, Andy, he, you know, all that goofy stuff and all the conceptual comedy he was doing on Saturday Night Live, when he went down to Memphis to wrestle, and he started, I guess, doing the intergender stuff on Saturday Night Live, people seem to think that maybe, or have the impression that he was only down there for a couple of weeks, that it was a gag. He was down there for like 2 years working it. He was a professional wrestler.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
By all, you know, intents and purposes, he's what's called in the business a worker.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And he knew how to get heat. Which, in, you know, wrestling parlance means to get, you know, people real angry at him, because he worked as the ultimate heel.
Uh-huh.
You know, as I always say, you know, about wrestling, I mean, my entree into wrestling, I was always a fan when I was a kid, and there was the night of what I call the great wrestling epiphany. We were like tripping our heads off on some acid, which seemed to be like the default position in those days, and watching Championship Wrestling on Channel 9 in New York. And Bob Backlund was the champion. Bob Backlund was this all-American boy, the golden boy. You know, he was this complete dweeb with a haircut and buzz cut, and he wrestled in a very, you know, Olympic style. He's very clean, and he get on TV and tell kids not to take drugs. He was just like the most awful person of all time. And his protege was this twerp named Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert. And they were teasing a match. It was going to be the next week against the Grand... the masked superstar, who was this thug who wore like a big star in his mask and a matching star in his shirt, and his manager, the Grand Wizard of Wrestling, who, if anybody remembers, was like the stoner's, every stoner's favorite manager. He wore his green turban and this, like, you know, vomit colored jacket, you know, madras jacket and bell bottoms and these wraparound shades. He's this old Jew from Florida, and he claimed to be the smartest man in the world.
That's the Grand Wizard.
The Grand Wizard of professional wrestling. He was the greatest. And he's coaching this guy, the masked superstar, to break Eddie Gilbert's legs. Break his legs, break his legs, snap his neck, snap his neck, snap his neck. And he does, you know? Give him the neck breaker. And he does. And there's the champ, Bob Backlund, watching his protege's neck being broken, and he starts crying. And it's like, oh man, you know, all things holy. The champion is crying. This is the guy that you're presenting as the toughest guy in the world. I mean, he's a fruit, right? It was like at that moment that I loved professional wrestling. Right. I was tripping my head off. And somehow within like 3 weeks, I had a job working for a professional wrestling magazine.
Now, which wrestlers were shepherded on from this original very hardcore era to once, like, I know Junkyard Dog, Jimmy Fi, Snuka,
sure.
Andre the Giant.
Well, Snuka was working back then, you know.
And Andre the Giant.
Andre.
He was a great, very interesting character.
He was certainly a great man. You know, there's a great story about Andre, you know, because he could drink like 7 cases of beer on the bus ride between gigs.
Unbelievable.
I mean, his bar tab one night, they went to shoot a movie, and his bar tab was like, you know, $1,800 just for him.
You know? That is so funny. Off beer.
He came to a hotel drunk, so drunk one night, and just passed out in the lobby. And this is a guy who was 8'4", weighed almost 700 pounds. Mm-hmm. He really was the eighth wonder of the world. And they couldn't move him, so they just threw a sheet over him, right? And put up a sign that says, please pardon us while we redecorate.
Oh my God. I love that. One story I love about him is he, of course, till even when he was a wreck and could barely walk anymore, he was in such pain from growing so much, he understood the importance of wrestling continuing beyond him. So even though he could have crushed Hulk Hogan with one of his hands, he allowed himself to be body slammed by Hulk Hogan to create the next generation.
Well, Hogan needs help because Hogan is the worst wrestler of all time. I mean,
really?
The guy couldn't wrestle out of a paper bag. He's terrible.
Just all personality,
he's terrible.
Though.
He's got the pathos of Big Bird.
But he knew how to get.
He looks like Big Bird. I think Ernie and Burke could take him in a fair fight. No, he is absolutely the worst wrestler of all time. He's got no skills. He does have a certain amount of charisma, but honestly, that stay in school, don't take drugs, you know, flag-waving Americana patriotism.
Doesn't work for us.
Not my kind of people.
What did you think of the movie, The Wrestler?
I liked it to a degree. I mean, it's a little corny. It's a little cliche, just in terms of, like, you know, a Rocky story of this guy making the comeback. I mean, Mickey Rourke's great.
Do you think it portrayed wrestling as you knew it in a real manner?
You know, what's interesting is the backstage stuff mostly is very accurate, especially in these, you know, high school gyms and, the, like, you know, these, like, kind of losing venues where he's performing, like, you know, in New Jersey. I got to say, it's the best movie about New Jersey ever made. If anybody's ever spent any time in Rahway or Elizabeth or Asbury Park recently, you know they're pulling no punches. You know, except Marissa Tomei, right?
Oh, she looked
I mean, Gabe, I know you. I know you hang out in strip bars in Elizabeth very often. Have you ever seen a girl that looked like that?
I don't think so. No, Marissa Tomei is in a pretty different class than what you tend to see at the classier establishments.
And tell me, what did you do in the wrestling world? You end up writing for one of their publications?
Yeah, I was the editor of a thing called Wrestling's Main Event, and I was the first heel editor. Meaning I was the first bad guy editor. You know, we figured that in wrestling there are good guys and bad guys. So the people who wrote the magazine, we shouldn't all have it in the tank for, you know, the good guys, the baby faces. Mm-hmm. I was getting tired of writing puff pieces about Hulk Hogan, who I can't stand. Mm-hmm. So I began a feud with Hogan and a feud with my editor, who was one of these do-gooding, flag-waving, milk-drinking, you know, Davy Crocketing good guys. And that's how I got my first job. I kicked the living shit out of him in the middle of the ring. I challenged him to a loser leaves town match. New Jersey street brawl rules.
Oh, my God.
We went down to Gleason's gym at midnight, and I hammered him with my heart punch. I mean, I dropped him like a bad habit. And then I went and I took over his office on the 84th floor of the Empire State Building. And that's how I got my first job as editor-in-chief.
Wow. Unbelievable. During a wrestling match.
Absolutely.
Hardcore. That's like a duel. That goes back to Alexander Hamilton. And that's but done much better.
Did Hulk Hogan ever make any personal threats against you?
I feel them at all times. You know, poor Hulk Hogan right now, he's in such bad shape. You know, I was enjoying our feud for so many years, but now, his kids are a mess. His wife divorced him. She's like shacked up with some teenager living in, you know, the house that Hulk Hogan bought. His one kid, you know, was in jail for manslaughter. He wrapped his, you know, car around a tree. His bimbo daughter is like, you know, this fledgling singing career that's just a sinkhole for money.
And a really fantastic TV show of her.
Oh, man.
She has her own show.
I mean, I always wanted to see him go down, but not like this. I take no glory in this.
So what should we talk about next? Should we talk about High Times next?
We could talk about High Times and pitch my book, of course.
Yeah. Of course, we'll pitch the book. But, I mean, tell us, when was this book written? I mean, what had you done before and what fed in? What can we read about in the book?
Well, the book's called I Have Fun Everywhere I Go. Uh-huh. Savage Tales of Pot, Porn, Punk Rock, Pro Wrestling, Talking Apes, Evil Bosses, Dirty Blues, American Heroes, and the Most Notorious Magazines in the World. And High Times, certainly high on that list. That dope rag is what my grandmother used to call it. She said, "You still working for that dope rag?"
Unbelievable. And
she actually preferred when I was working for porn magazines, I think, because I think she thought at least sex might lead to grandchildren.
So you got, I mean, you wrote a lot of pornography. I mean, what is the art to
I paid for my apartment
writing film?
Pornography.
What's the key to writing a good porn film? I mean,
I didn't write films. Oddly, it's the one thing in the business I didn't write. I mean, I wrote 28 porn novels, adult novels. The first one was called Cindy's Brutal Ordeal. I think the last one was Angela Class Virgin. I think that was the last one. And boy, man, it was torture by the time I got the last one. It was like, each word was like pulling teeth. But we wrote everything. I wrote, my masterpiece was actually a gay book, a homosexual book. It was called His Black Boyfriend. And when I got the assignment, we used to work in this old sort of mob-run typesetting operation. And the idea was we'd sit in this office with these very primitive computers, K-Pro computers, if anybody remembers that. They worked on an operating system called CPM, which is, you know, like pre-DOS, right? And apparently the only good thing it's good for is writing porn novels.
When is this?
This is late 80s, mid 80s, 87.
Okay.
Yeah, 86. I guess I was out by 87. 86, 87.
Was this
right after I dropped out of school the first time.
Was this immediately following your stint in the Empire State Building?
Yeah, exactly. It was after the wrestling thing kind of went south, just due to, like, you know, bad employer, and also the fact that the WWF and Vince McMahon had created his own magazines and had really cut down the market for, you know, any competing product.
Lowered the common denominator, though, didn't he?
Well, the business had changed, and he basically owned everything. And that includes the newsstand. Mm-hmm. Smart guy, Vince. You know, I admire him greatly. I think he's a very, he's a great man. You know, perhaps even greater than Ted Kennedy.
And he's still doing his thing.
Not Vince, a patient. Oh, man, yeah. But. Vince is the greatest, you know? But when we got to the writing of the porn books, and it was just sort of a job that I fell into. I was a writer struggling doing this wrestling magazine. I just dropped out of NYU. And this guy says to me, hey, would you like to write pornography? And I said, quite frankly, you know, I never really thought about it. You know, I mean, I got a couple, you know, magazines stashed away like all the boys do. But frankly, I think it's kind of boring, you know? You know, it's very repetitive. And, you know, it's kind of a one riff kind of kind of thing.
That story usually ends the same way.
And he said, "Well, you know, I know people who need these books, and you seem to be able to write and type fast, which is a prereq for this gig. Go up and see what you can do." So I went up to this guy's office, and they're very nice. This big loft right by the J.P. Morgan Library in Midtown. You know, was it like 38th Street and 3rd Avenue. And they said, okay, you can type. Sure, I can type. I mean, really, that's what they cared about. Mm-hmm. And he sat me down on this old IBM Selectric, you know, one of these old big, you know, with the clack and cluttering IBM ball, the Selectric ball, right? Which was like the detritus of someone's office. And he goes, okay, Jack and Jill, sit him on the couch, then bring in the camera and give me like 500 words of blowjob. And that was my job. That was my job interview. So there you had it. Jack is on the couch, Jill's on the couch, and one thing leads to the next. And Jill goes for the okie doke, and 500 liters of sputtering and whirring and clicking from this typewriter. You know, I had written, you know, my first oral sex masterpiece.
Fantastic.
And they took one look at it and said, "Congratulations, you're hired." But then he had to tell me the rules. He said, "Well." He said, "Well, we do have some rules here. First of all, the stories have to have beginnings and middles and ends. They do have to be books. We do like plot and conflict and resolution, if you know what that means." You know, I was a somewhat college educated guy. I had an idea what that was. He said, "Okay, nothing that can't really happen. In other words, no Martians from outer space. Mm-hmm. In the S&M books, nothing that doesn't heal. Mm-hmm. Okay, no scars that don't heal. That's very important. And no one dies in these books. You don't like people dying, like happy endings." He's like, "Well, there's one other thing."
It's like Hollywood.
Yeah, "Well, there's one other thing," he says. "Oh, yeah, no poop eating." And he looks at me and goes, "I know what you're thinking, but there are still Puritans working in this business." So the best book I read was my gay book. And he assigned me the title. It was called His Black Boyfriend. Because while I was writing these books, I usually write about a book a week. They're about 45,000 words each. And I'd write a book. And while I was doing that, presumably somebody was, you know, making a masterpiece out of the cover. You know, the house artist was, you know, in his castle, you know, painting these like beautiful covers.
Are they like Daniel Steele covers? Or?
They're really soft watercolors. They're totally inappropriate for the subject matter of the book. So I said, "Look, Skip, you know, what do I know about gay sex, honestly? You know, I don't know how I'm going to write this book." And he said, "Well, look, Edison, you got a hole and you got a pole and it don't change. Now sit down and write your book." So I sort of looked at the screen for a while, and it occurred to me that His Black Boyfriend could be about Hulk Hogan and Mr. T. Who were battling the first WrestleMania right at the time. After that, the book just wrote itself.
Totally.
Oh, man.
You know, these guys I hated, and the whole premise of the book is, you know, they couldn't make it to the ring because they were too busy, you know, sticking cocaine up each other's rumps. And,
unbelievable.
And that's my best work. An interracial homosexual masterpiece.
Sounds amazing. So
I put the chiaroscuro back in sex.
So tell us, and then what else can we read about? First of all, can people buy this book anywhere, right?
Yeah, sure. Amazon.com, Better Booksellers everywhere, and certainly from me on my website, MikeEdison.com.
MikeEdison.com?
Yep, and there's lots of good stuff on MikeEdison.com. There are comics. There are a lot of MP3s of me reading from the book with my band.
Tell us about your band while you mention it.
Well, right now, my band is called the Space Liberation Army. And this is a band that's specifically dedicated to playing when I do read for my book. And it's somewhat of an X-rated psychedelic comedy show. There's some beatnik vibes and some punk rock boogaloo. John Spencer, he of Blues Explosion and Pussy Galore and Boss Hog, mm-hmm. is my collaborator and my guitar player. We're going to be playing at the Knitting Factory in Brooklyn, the new Knitting Factory, okay. October 17th. It's part of the Royal Flush Film Festival. And it'll be me and my Space Liberation Army. Actually, Gary Lucas is going to be playing guitar with us that night. Gary, who's played with Jeff Buckley and Captain Beefheart and Joan Osborne, and of course is a star in his own right. And yeah, it's a good night. October 17th, save the date. But come on to MikeEdison.com. You get a dose and find out what it's all about.
Cool. And then do you talk about your time at Screw Magazine? Is it true you succeeded Al Goldstein as the editor?
Yeah. You know, and I've nothing but fondness for Al Goldstein, who's in terrible shape right now, unfortunately. I mean, I think Screw, actually, like High Times, is a clear case of be careful of what you wish for. Mm-hmm. You know, because when I got to High Times, it seemed like the ideal job, and that got queered real fast, too. I mean, trying to, you know, herd a bunch of stoners and putting out a magazine, it's astonishing anything ever got done there. I mean, it was just retarded, you know, in the most fundamental ways. You know, I describe it as like one of those Discovery Channel documentaries where they slow everything down so you can see how the animal's legs work. That's what it was like hanging out in the hallway at High Times. Screw was a gas because Screw was licensed to ill. We could say anything we wanted to.
Right.
And Screw had this great tradition of being very smart and very political. It was a lot sharper and hipper than I think people would realize. I think most people know of Screw, but actually haven't seen it. Right. They know Al from Midnight Blue. You know, he was on TV. He was such a New York TV staple.
Channel
for so long.
J.
Right? It was the best. And just ranting and raving. And he could be terribly smart, but he also could be very petty and mean when he felt like it. And, you know, he's got a lot of demons.
He does. Well, back to High Times. What are your beliefs on marijuana? I mean, you believe that drugs should be legalized?
Absolutely.
Across the country and world?
I think we're seeing a trend that way, right? I was just reading... in Denver, they want to make the maximum penalty for possession of weed $1, which isn't quite legal, but it's clearly stating it's not worth it.
Right.
They used to, when I was at High Times, I used to get asked all the time, will marijuana ever be legal? And I always said, well, not per se. You know, meaning they're not going to write it off the books because politicians are just too soft. You know, they're just too pussy, honestly, to come out and say, we need to decrim marijuana because they're just going to get beaten up by people saying they're soft on drugs or you don't care about the children.
Right. Of all the issues they could take up, they don't want to push that one.
That
through.
Is, you know, that's, I mean,
it's
the third.
It's
unfortunate.
Political suicide.
It's, yes, yeah, it's the third bong of American politics. Yeah. There's nothing you can do about it, even though we all know at this point that marijuana is basically pretty benign, that it could be controlled, it could be taxed, that a lot of people are smoking. It, that it's ridiculous that, you know, basically 28 million Americans are now criminals because they, you know, behave this way. I mean, this, you know, begs the question of prohibition in general, which is liquor prohibition, but also the prohibition of pornography. And we saw how that worked out. I mean, prohibition just doesn't work.
I was thinking there'd be more than 28 million. I would think somehow there's like 100 million or something Americans.
Well, I think the three people in this room probably count for about like the first 100,000, just in terms of quotidian.
Right. this is the Q report. But I was thinking even in those sad places, you know, where no one's around and you're all alone. I mean, it almost becomes a necessity, you know, to have
a necessity?
Something.
That's sick. A necessity, huh?
A necessity.
You see, that's the problem. I'll tell you what, though. Let's talk about methamphetamine for a second.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's on the meth train somehow, but I've never actually...
You know, I love meth. You know, I love speed. It's such a good drug, don't you think? Like, here's the problem. The problem isn't methamphetamine. The problem is daytime television, okay? Because back when we were, like, snorting crank, and we're running around Europe in my bands, and this is what you're supposed to do. Crank, speed, you know, amphetamines, meth, what it's designed for, like when the, you know, the German government, the American government perfected it, is made to win wars. It's made so you can drive a truck across the country. You know, it's made so, like, Lemmy can play in Motorhead. Okay, you know, this is what it's for. So if you're doing this drug and you're playing bass in Motorhead, you know, we're just hanging out with the Stooges, you know, this is what the drug is for and it's all good. When you're doing this drug and you're watching, you know, Jerry Springer and Oprah, well, no kidding, your teeth are going to fall out. That's not what the drug is for. Tweaking at home. The drug itself is not supposed to be the activity. The drug is meant to win wars and play in Motorhead. Right. When used properly, it's a wonderful thing.
So, tell us, did you take these political views? I mean, did you gear
Doesn't
High
make
time?
Me popular in some circles, no.
Right. I know, I can imagine. But, like, did High Times legitimate? What role did High Times play in legitimating marijuana use in America?
Zero.
Was that its battle? Or?
Well, it's completely ineffectual, which is a shame, but, you know, kind of understandable, too. High Times has the reputation of just being, you know, a bunch of stone clods. And it's a reputation that they can't seem to shake. And, you know, it needs to be done very, very, very gingerly. I mean, they painted themselves into this corner as stoners, and not that everyone there, you know, is just like working a cloud of smoke, but it does seem like there are. And honestly, people don't really want Socratic debate over right. there any more than they do in the rest of the country. The believers believe, and the non-believers just want to yell and scream at them, and we're not really having a conversation. I mean, any logical conversation would come to the conclusion that the war on drugs is a massive failure.
Right.
You know, and, you know, we need to rethink it. At High Times, I mean, and Normal, nice people, you know, the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws, great people, they haven't moved the ball one inch. Mm-hmm. You know, it's unfortunate. It'll happen on its own, where when law enforcement realizes it's a mistake. Still a lot of crazy rednecks out there mm-hmm. and kooks who think marijuana is somehow subversive. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think? As a political statement, I think marijuana is kind of passe.
I mean, the issue of legalization is a hard one to get into because you make reference to it being a taxable commodity and everything, but it's also something that everyone can, you know, make themselves, which, you know, I think a lot of, on the level of if anyone ever took the time to think about it honestly and whether or not it's a good idea, it's scary to think that it's something that they actually can't control.
It's everywhere.
Does that make sense?
It does, and it is true. I mean, even though it is kind of a myth, I mean, I believe that, you know, you smoke that doobie and the doors of perception do open. I mean, certainly my experience.
Did you ever see that thing in Taxi when Christopher Lloyd takes his first hit in college and he immediately, the second later, after he inhales, he acquires that, you know, signature vape? You know, it took him 1 second before.
I know, the guys at High Times took him years. Oh, yeah. That. I think it's true. My experiences with LSD are the same, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really did, you know. It's cliche again. I apologize, but it's true. That opened the doors of perception. I saw the world in a much different way. You know, I was very much more questioning of authority and really realized the absurdity in, you know, day to day things, and was not taking things so seriously that were presented to me as dogma.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us about Hebe.
Hebe magazine. Those Jews. What do you want to know?
They'll be in the book, too. You wrote about Hebe in your book.
Yeah, I was one of the principals of Hebe magazine. Very for it when it started out. Jennifer Blyer, who founded the magazine, is a great friend of mine and still, you know, a very close friend of mine and whom I admire greatly. And she started the magazine really on a whim. She had applied for a grant from Steven Spielberg's fund for Jewish cultural projects. She basically wrote the application on the back of a napkin. Hmm. You know, said, hey, we want to start this Jewish Kipster magazine for a touchstone for young Jews who have no other cultural touchstone. What do you think? And they thought $60,000. I mean, really, she just stuffed an envelope in stuffed a cocktail napkin in an envelope and got a check back.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it wasn't much more than that. And it was great.
It's enough to start it?
Yeah, I think what happened is, and I do go into this in details, I do dame names, the current regime, who is suffering from a serious talent deficit, and the clown that later become the publisher and the editor, really, you know, I think he was making all the mistakes that, you know, despots and egomaniacs make when they get to run magazines. Same as Steve Hager over at High Times, and he was putting himself before, you know, the reader and what he wanted to do. I think basically the whole reason he took over the magazine was he wanted to screw Sarah Silverman. I think that was pretty much his whole idea.
It was
of doing
one
screw.
Big, massive
yeah,
attempt.
Sort of like when the Hinckley guy wanted to do Jodie Foster by killing Reagan. You know, it's just not going to work out.
It's like shooting the moon a little too far.
Yeah, it's a noble idea. You know, I'd like to be with Sarah. I'd like to be with Jodie. You know, not bloody likely. But, you know, I'm not going to do it by starting a magazine or by shooting the president. Yeah, you know, I think it's just got a little too edgy for edgy's sakes and not earnest enough, I mean, for my taste. I mean, they're doing well, and that's fine. I wish success to them. Because mm-hmm. I think it's true. I think, you know, young Jews, such as they are, do need some sort of cultural stereotype. But I think when they're just sort of reaching into the dumpsters in Williamsburg for whatever and forgetting about, you know, there's very little content about what I would consider great Jewish culture, the Marx Brothers, or I know I sound like an old man and they're trying to avoid that, but Abby Hoffman and the great Jewish counterculture, I think there's a, you know, part of the responsibility is to educate and keep that alive.
Yeah, but those aren't, you know, uncovered topics.
No, they're not, but it's not even those specifically those topics. It's more in the spirit of that that I would like to keep. And, you know, everything doesn't have to be what's on Comedy Central this week. Kill all the publicists first, that's what I say.
And do you like Hustler and Penthouse and Playboy? I mean, do you think they've served a purpose or do you respect them?
Yeah, I mean, Playboy is probably the greatest magazine of all time for a certain run, probably from the late 50s to right up into the early 70s. I mean, Hefner's kind of a cynical marketer, and I think he's somewhat of a fraud. Just in terms, he's so into the marketing and the image that I don't think he's honest. Whereas a guy like Larry Flint, who says, I'm a pornographer. He says, mm-hmm. you know, I'm this hillbilly, and these are my girls, and I'm a pig. And at least with him, you know what you're getting.
Right.
Same with Al Goldstein and Bob Guccione. They're very upfront about it. A lot of people don't know this. Playboy's corporate policy is never to cooperate with a journalist who will do a story about quote-unquote pornography, because they want to keep the word pornography as far away from their brand as possible.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, he spits a bunch of, you know, bullshit about how he's liberated women, how he's helped, you know, he's liberated sex, but especially I've liberated women. And I'm telling you, putting a bunny tail on a woman's butt and putting ears on her and having her, you know, subserviently serve cocktails is not liberating anybody.
Right, right. <You know? laughs> Yeah, no, absolutely. Very, very interesting. I had couple of questions, last minute questions. We have a call in, actually. Very cool. Was it you, Gabe?
Not this time.
No, this is a real bona fide call in. What was Ted Kennedy's stance on marijuana legalization?
You know, interestingly enough, I don't know exactly the answer in any great detail, but when I was just prepping for this and I was sort of going through the index of my book, and oh, here's Ted Kennedy. And I'm like, dang, what did I write about Ted? He was instrumental in getting Paul McCartney out of Japan when Paul got busted. Hmm. And they kept him there for 9 days until Ted interfered.
Wow.
So good old Teddy to the rescue.
I remember him getting, he was a little bit of a bad boy himself, wasn't he?
I can imagine that Teddy was a dope smoking, coke snorting, you know, whiskey swilling womanizer. I mean, his brothers were dropping acid. You know, everybody was doing pills. I can't imagine that Ted Kennedy, given the era that he grew up, was not exposed to marijuana.
Yeah, I mean, it is absolutely. I mean, I have to say, I mean, in the 60s, so many more people. I mean, I don't know. It would be hard to imagine that everyone didn't try it a couple times.
I mean, everyone had to, right?
Well, anybody sitting on that side of the aisle. I mean, I think there were things were right. Polarized then in ways that you can't really imagine.
He had some funny things. They called him Rablesian, you know, in the New York Times.
Which is great.
And when John was running for president, Ted was assigned like a little bit of a lesser role to rally Western votes that usually ended up going Republican. So he got all into it, and he was like riding a Bronco at the rodeo. And at one time, he took a really dramatic ski jump at a winter sports tournament in Wisconsin. I mean, this guy was a hardcore partier, and you know, it was only later in life that he settled into his role as a true senator, you know?
Well, I mean, I think much later in life when he settled down, even when he was a senator, you know, the first part of his career, when he was married to, you know, to Joan, he was doing good work, but, you know, he was getting loaded all the time. People knew what he was up to. I mean, he was a rock star. He was a rock star, and you know, I'm not much into dynasties. I don't trust them, but he definitely inherited all the privilege that came with that,
and responsibility,
but also like you know the swagger and the money. You know, I mean, come on,
they were one of the richest families in the country.
I mean, the guy drank more liquor, you know, and screwed more girls than Frank Sinatra.
Oh my God, Frank is like, no, it was me. anyway, well, very interesting. So what do you have thoughts? Were you sad when he died or?
Yeah, I definitely felt a loss. I think anybody of conscience would have to. I mean, here was a guy that I love Ted Kennedy because he was so up in the faces of these jerk off Republicans and conservatives and really took no prisoners. It's weird to hear people talking, oh, he was knew how to compromise. Mm-hmm. It may be behind doors. He could, you know, they could shake hands and agree on something. But when it came to women's rights, to the voting rights, to the Clean Water Act, to all these great things, he wasn't budging an inch.
Right.
I mean, he was like Reagan's archenemy. He was like the Joker to like Reagan's Batman.
Right, right.
You know? I mean,
or maybe the other way around.
Or vice versa. He was like Shane, you know, he was like Alan Ladd to like Reagan's Jack Palance, you know, the evil homesteader, the railroad guy. He was the straight razor to Reagan's eyeball if they had both starred in Shenandoah.
He was Mr. Edwards to the Ingalls' owners of the Mercantile.
What I was going to say next.
Well, what was their name? Anyway, that was we should talk about Laura Ingalls Wilder one day on this show.
But yeah, I think it's you know, I mean, no one's going to replace Ted.
No,
I mean everybody is too freaking soft, to be honest with you. I mean, no one's got the balls that he had.
Yeah,
that's a room full of grapes. What did you say? He had grapefruits.
Exactly, room full of grapes. He had grapefruits. He was he was a real lion, and it seems like almost like his personal fallacies, like things he did wrong, he also tried to fix those, but he also tried to fix all our wrongs, you know, ignoring poor people. And
yeah, I mean, I think his social responsibility and the work he did was fantastic. I mean, that Chappaquiddick thing was a disaster. I mean, he failed the test. He could not be the president.
Well, that's why he couldn't be president. Yeah.
No way. Yeah. He wouldn't have gotten my vote after that. He failed the test.
If he hadn't fled the scene, could he have survived it?
If he had saved the girl?
No, if she had died, but
called the police right away.
Chappaquiddick? Was it because he left and he didn't call the police for
10 hours after leaving the scene of the accident.
He went home and he swam across the bridge between Chappaquiddick Island and the mainland. I've been to that bridge. I've smoked plenty of dope on that bridge. Yeah. And let me tell you, it's easy to drive off. There are no rails on it. There are no lights. It's just in the middle of, like, you know, this Chappaquiddick's a small island off of Martha's Vineyard. There's a breach. The ferry is only, you know, 5 minutes back and forth. If you ever see Jaws, the movie Jaws, that little ferry, that's actually that's the Chappaquiddick ferry. And he swam across that and didn't call the police and left the girl there. What would Harrison Ford have done? I ask you.
Harrison Ford.
And that's why Harrison Ford got to be president. Flockhart
have done. So thank you so much, Mike. It's a real honor. I mean, you are a cultural institution, no doubt. And it's good to see you around here at Roberta's, and hopefully you'll come back beyond
that. I would love to. I love Roberta's. You guys know that, and I'm How really glad to be not? Here with you on The Q.
Awesome. The Q Report, we are brought to you by Picnic, and we're going to come back and talk more about Ted Kennedy with Renato Sardo and Brian Kenny.
Records that get played from our own disco, which we call Sound System. Sound System has done miracles, 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 miracles,
this is a season of hope. New hope for a justice and fair prosperity for the many and not just for the few. New hope. And this is the cause of my life. New hope that we will break the old gridlock and guarantee that every American, North, South, East, West, young, old, will have decent, quality health care as a fundamental right and not a privilege.
Wow, that is a dramatic Ted Kennedy speech at the Democratic National Convention.
Absolutely.
Well, he was a great guy. I mean, I did a lot of reading on him, and you know, once I heard about his death, I mean, he was the last Kennedy to hold high office, or it's the first time in 62 years. So, I took some notes, mainly from the New York Times, but apparently he once said, "I am part of all whom I met." And one of his sons talked about being at a hotel and saying, "Dad, you left some money on the sink. You know, we should take that." And he said, "Son, you know, making beds is backbreaking work." You know, that's a powerful thing. A lot of people don't realize that, even though it's so close to them and they're in that same thing. By the time he had graduated high school, he'd already attended 10 preparatory schools. And that constant moving might have made him more genial with strangers. He was the chairman of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, and Labor Pensions. And he started fighting for health care in 1966 when he won a $51 million in appropriations for 30 community health centers. He came, he was in the Senate since 1963, kind of more noble times in the Senate. As an example, there was one filibuster in 1963, which is like the real, you know, worst case scenario for a very important cause. There was one in 1963. Last year, there were 51 filed. So it just shows there's a lot more partisan division, you know, not certainly so much, you know, reaching across the aisle. He was the youngest child of Joseph Kennedy and Rose Fitzgerald. He survived. He was the only Kennedy boy to die, you know, of semi-natural causes. Mm-hmm. John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy were felled by assassins. And Joseph Kennedy, his eldest brother, died in 19...
the war.
Yep. During a bombing mission. Actually, Ted almost died in a plane crash in 1964 that saw his pilot and one of his aides die on a way to a state convention. And actually, his wife...
escaped narrowly.
Yeah, his wife had to run his campaign for him. He was in the hospital for 6 months. And then in 1992, he married Victoria Ann Reggie, a Washington lawyer. And there was this really touching line. It was said that the oldest Joseph would keep the political Kennedy flame alive, then John, then Robert, and if he died too, then Ted. And someone said when he sees them in heaven, he can say, I did it. I carried the torch. I carried it all the way. You know, the one Kennedy in the dynasty. And then just some last minute things, then we're going to come. He was compared to Daniel Webster, Calhoun, and Clay as one of the greatest senators of all time. And in September 11th, there were about 46 families or maybe there were 11 families from Massachusetts who lost someone at the World Trade Center. And he called all of them over and over and over again to make sure they were okay. So, you know, very interesting guy. And, you know, for the rest of our show, we wanted to kind of bring in a group of our trusted advisors and talk about his passing. So we have Renato Sardo and Brian Kenny. Are you guys with us?
I am.
Yeah, I'm here.
Brian.
Hey, well, thanks for being on at Gabe and me here at the studio. So what did you think when you heard that Ted Kennedy passed?
This is Brian Kenny here in California. It's the end of an era. I mean, whatever your politics, I think you have to accept the fact that Ted Kennedy was the real deal. I think he was a statesman, and everybody's got their demons and their shortcomings, and I'm sure he had a boatload of them. I never met him personally, but I'm sure he had a boatload of them. But I think when you look at the final count, the Voting Rights Act, the Age Discrimination Act, Freedom of Information Act, these were things that had his hand on them. And it's kind of like Bob Dylan. You know, Bob Dylan's worst album would be someone else's best. Damn near anybody else's best. And I think Ted Kennedy, for all of his shortcomings as a human being, which is what I hear a lot of, but he shaped the country in a positive direction. I think the Freedom of Information Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Age Discrimination Act in and of themselves are pretty good examples.
And Renato, tell us from like an international perspective, was he known, or how are the Kennedys viewed in Italy?
He was seen as the last of the clan. So I've read a little bit of eulogies in Italian papers. Funny, because the left, the sort of center left papers, gave a lot more space to that than the pro Berlusconi governments. But basically, most of the lines were, you know, the end of an era, dynasty at the sunset. And it was funny because there wasn't much about the track record at the Senate, even if it was said that, you know, it was expected Senate, but it was all about the history of the Kennedy, the clan, the fact of when he had the car accident many years ago. It was kind of gossipy and not very informative.
Princess Diana or something, that kind of... a nobility, almost like a king.
Exactly. It was the same sort of profiling. There wasn't much track there wasn't much about what he really did. It was mostly about, you know, this tragic figure in the tragic family of the Kennedy. It was all about that.
Interesting.
And it was funny because in Italy, if someone like him would die, I think, you know, we would have an ethical reform because everyone would be so touched that they would go for it.
They would think it was a message from the saints or something. We have to do
it. Well, exactly. You know, the only time that the communists won in Italy in the 80s won when the secretary of the party died. Oh, and so everyone was probably some European election. And I thought we would have the same effect. Well, here, strangely enough, there is the opposite effect. Everyone is kind of concerned that without him, there won't be enough energy to go through.
Brian, Brian Kenny, if you get gored by a Hearst bull, you'll get all American cafeterias to go grass-fed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, in Italy.
At least for 3 months.
Now, Brian, Brian, exactly. Brian, I wanted to ask you.
It would be business as usual.
Exactly. Yeah. Did he have any work? Now, I know you work on the largest land easement in the state of California. Were the Democrats or the kind of liberals like Kennedy good for nature and national parks and conservation?
Well, my involvement in the political aspect is incredibly limited. But I think it's safe to say in terms of politicians that there, even the politicians from rural areas that should have more of a sensitivity to agrarian issues, they really don't because there aren't a whole lot of them. They don't have a whole lot of voting power in all the populations in the cities. So I think that there have been a lot of well-intended pieces of legislation to protect the environment and things of that nature. But as someone on the practicing end of the spectrum, preservation's led to a lot of dead forests and a lot of very, you know, undiverse grasslands. And I think that one of the biggest problems is that we run into with politicians is that you have people whose business is really influence, and when you try to sit down and explain to them that, you know, it's as simple as this. Good things are good, bad things are bad. Well-managed grazing, well-managed foresting, like that Hearst practices in our timberlands up near Mount Shasta and our grasslands in California, those are actually good for the environment. Mm-hmm. And trying to explain to a politician that wildfire is actually part of a healthy forest ecosystem, or at least it was before Woodsy the Owl. Now, as a result of not having forest fires, we have huge fuel loads in the forest, and we have huge infestations of beetles that are killing trees. So in terms of who's been good and who's been bad, I just think
it's
a shortcoming of the system is that if you're in Washington, honestly, Ted Kennedy would be unelectable today. I mean, he got into the walls of power at a time when the press was genteel toward politicians and Bobby and...
Well, maybe he could. I mean, you don't think the name means anything? I mean, Renato, does the name mean enough to win an election? Like, for instance, Shriver, you know, Schwarzenegger's wife. I mean, is there still a Kennedy mystique this far out, you know, or have they lost their Arthurian, you know, magic?
I think there is. If you read the article in Italy, it's all about Kennedy mystiques. Black and white images of the 60s. So there is definitely that. I don't know how strong it is here. But from my point of view, there is. You know, Kennedy touches chords, the name. And I think a name is enough to win. Yes.
Okay. I guess, let me rephrase my statement. In light of Chappaquiddick, if Chappaquiddick were to have happened today, and Kennedy had been in office for 6 years like he had been at the time that it happened, that would have been the end of it.
Although, you know, he did go on to television and ask, he's like, voters, should I resign?
Yeah, it was a different time.
I don't know how they would have voted no if it wasn't. Well, right. They would have had
it wasn't like American Idol. But, I mean, the thing that's changed that I see, and I don't think it's for the better, but if you just turn on cable television, there's so much news content. That's everything. Is there's so many news channels. It's insane.
It is absolutely.
There's no the cycle of substance. You know that Michael Jackson was mentioned more times in the 3 weeks after his passing than Afghanistan had been mentioned and covered in the news all year.
Hmm.
We're fighting a war in Afghanistan, and Michael Jackson dies of a manslaughter.
Shows how important it is that stars dedicate their names to good causes.
Well,
they do get stuff.
Yeah,
well,
no, it's,
but I think yeah, that exactly. The fact that Kennedy brings such a big baggage, the name, even something like that accident could, if it was called Smith or something else, probably would have his career would have ended. The fact that he's a Kennedy, the fact that there is so much there, probably. That accident enters immediately. It's more contextualized.
It's true. I have the perfect way to end this because it's been very interesting. I think you guys gave great perspective. It said most people grow up and go into politics. The Kennedys go into politics and then grow up. So, I mean, he definitely had some of his weird things. But Brian and Renato, thanks so much for being on and lending this. It was really interesting to have the Italian perspective in particular. And it's been a great show. We've had Mike Edison was our first guest.
Check out the website, MikeEdison.com.
And the book is I Have Fun Everywhere I Go, Savage Tales of Pop, Porn, Punk, Rock, Pro Wrestling, Talking Apes, Evil Bosses, Dirty Blues, American Heroes, and the most notorious magazines in the world.
Obviously, I'm trying to build my own Camelot.
He is building his own Camelot, and there's no doubt here at Roberta's, he is Arthur.